Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Prostate Cancer. And today's program is part one of a two-part series on living with metastatic prostate cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as prostate cancer-specific organizations. And it really is because of all of your interest in the program and all of the different collaborating organizations that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. And we have over 587 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, France, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to all of you that you're with us today, because this is a very important topic for all of you on the call today. Today's program has been supported by Astellas US, LLC, Medivation, Inc., and by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, this two-part series, and also for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have really the best of the best speakers today on the call, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Slovin is going to be addressing advances in the treatment of metastatic prostate cancer, understanding personalized medicine, standard of care, including chemotherapy, and treatment of bone metastases. So with that, I'm going to turn this program over to Dr. Slovin, thank you, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a treat for me to try to update you on the latest and the greatest, as they say, in prostate cancer treatment. We're going to focus today on discussing treatment modalities for patients who have metastatic prostate cancer. And sometimes it's easier to break it down into different categories. And the categories by which we would be looking at treatments, including clinical trials, which is something I always recommend for patients, looking at androgen receptor-targeted therapies, immunotherapy, chemotherapy, and some of the radiopharmaceuticals. Now, it sounds like a lot, but in reality, all of these treatment categories are interchangeable along the continuum of your cancer as it's changing from perhaps being responsive to one particular drug and then becomes unresponsive and then goes on to the next treatment. So a lot of these can be moved around and used earlier or later. So the standard therapies still prevail for patients who present, for example, with a cancer at diagnosis. And what we're talking about is patients who have disease, in particular, in the bone. Hormonal therapy, which is a means of causing the testosterone level, which is the male hormone, to be reduced and therefore sort of try to shrink the tumor, remains a mainstay of treatment. And this has been around for a very long time and is associated with improvement in quality of life as well as being able to induce remission of the disease. More recently, there have been studies that have brought to light that the addition of chemotherapy, in particular the standard of care which is often used in metastatic prostate cancer called docetaxel or Taxotere, has been shown to have added benefit if used in patients very early on at the time of diagnosis should they have metastatic disease. And what's interesting about it is that it's not for everybody, because if you look at somebody who has four little areas that light up on a bone scan as being representative of metastatic disease, another person who can have four of those little lesions may have a completely different kind of configuration. It may be even bigger. Some of the lesions may be blending or coalescing, or they just may be in large dark spots. And that is why when one is making this kind of recommendation, one really has to look at the patient's imaging and determine whether or not the addition of chemotherapy for that patient is relevant. But it is something that's been new, and it's been now validated into two large phase 3 trials. Now, when this no longer works, what happens? Well, very often, just by changing the pills that are often given with the chemotherapy or the pills that are given along with the hormone injections, we can actually change the course and the biology of the cancer. We are using a variety of new hormonal manipulating agents called androgen receptor targeted therapies. They work at a particular site on the tumor cell known as the androgen receptor, where the male hormone testosterone usually binds. Now, for those of you who may already be aficionados in prostate cancer, your first question should be, well, if I'm already taking injections that prevent me from making testosterone, why would I need additional drugs that will knock down my testosterone again? Well, that's because the tumor itself, as it becomes more and more resistant to therapy, starts to make its own testosterone. This particular site on the tumor cell called the androgen receptor, where testosterone would normally bind, becomes overactive. And when it does so, the tumor itself, or the tumor cells, will start producing testosterone that is well below the limits of detectability in the bloodstream, but nevertheless, there are ways of detecting it in other modalities. So using drugs such as enzalutamide, the other name for that is Xtandi, or abiraterone, the other name for that is Zytiga, are very reasonable agents that are very effective. Should that not work, then chemotherapy with docetaxel works very nicely. And in fact, the two AR-directed therapies, enzalutamide and abiraterone, can be used after a person receives chemotherapy first. So they are acceptable treatment modalities before chemotherapy, or if you've been treated with chemotherapy first, are approved for their use after chemo. So you have a lot of flexibility, at least in part of the doctor, in determining where this would be best serving the patient. In the second line setting, meaning if chemotherapy doesn't work, we have an approved chemotherapy drug called cabazitaxel. The other name for it is Gemtana, which also tends to be very effective for our patients. I have people who ask me all the time, well, when should I get chemotherapy? You know, when is it appropriate? Well, it's frankly appropriate at diagnosis, as I've just alluded to. It is also appropriate for patients who, for example, may be symptomatic, meaning that they don't feel well, they're not eating, they're not thriving. It's acceptable for patients whose PSAs are doubling or tripling so quickly that I can't get my hands really around that PSA and find a drug that slows it down, and therefore chemotherapy would be very reasonable. And then the third, and that occurs more frequently than not, is someone who may need so much radiation that I will not be able to control their disease, nor would they be able to tolerate it, and there are so many different sites that would need the radiation, that chemotherapy would be very appropriate. It improves quality of life, it improves pain, and it has a lot of other benefits that are very, very well tolerated. For patients who have symptoms of their cancer, sometimes related to pain, we have a new radiopharmaceutical, which means it's a radioactive compound that is bone targeting. The other name for it is radium-223. It was actually originally discovered, I think, by Marie Curie at the turn of the 19th century. But the important thing is that this has been used for in an effort to palliate pain and has been used very safely in patients because it can be redosed. Patients can get it monthly for a total of 6 straight months, and it's accompanied by, we hope, an improvement in somebody's pain control, their ability to maintain their activities of daily living. Not every patient who receives this drug will have an impact on their PSA because it was really not put into that kind of analysis. It was really for pain control. Now, what's exciting? Well, as I mentioned before, we have tremendous flexibility in manipulating these treatments before or after chemo, earlier in the disease, later in the disease, something that we couldn't do years ago. But what's also very interesting is the fact that we're now able to do these proverbial liquid biopsies, meaning that we are able to take samples of blood and look at circulating tumor cells. These are cells that we believe are shed by the primary tumor. They're in the circulation. They're usually a propensity of these cells in patients who have a lot of disease, but it's not always guaranteed. We don't really see it in somebody who just has a rising PSA after surgery or radiation, but it's really in patients who have a lot more disease, such as in bone or in lymph nodes. One is able to analyze these circulating tumor cells in such a way that we have been able to associate it with treatment responses. So if a number of circulating tumor cells declines, we know that this is likely going to be associated with a biologic response, even if the PSA is not indicative of this. What's also very exciting nowadays is the idea of genomic profiling. And I would put caution out there that there's going to be a lot of sites on the internet advertising that they can tell you everything and anything that you need to know about your cancer. A lot of these places are not validated, meaning that only very specific laboratories, usually associated with major academic centers or think tanks, are really able to do this in such a manner and with such perspicacity that it has some merit. So we're doing that to identify mutations that might be, as we call them, actionable, meaning that we probably or may have a drug at some point that could treat the mutations. And this is something that's been ongoing in ovarian and breast cancer, looking at what we call the BRCA, BRCA mutations for a very high-risk patient population. But this has also been now seen in selected patients who have prostate cancer. It's still very small relative to other mutations. But the point is, this is something that has the potential to be treated by a drug because we've identified the mutation. It's an extremely exciting time now if one has prostate cancer, largely because there is such an amalgam of treatments that are effective and improve quality of life and are certainly allowing patients to continue to enjoy activities as they grow older. In fact, I would say that the average person that I'm now seeing in clinic who's been with me is anywhere from 15 to 20 years, and that is something that is unprecedented. So I'm going to stop right now. I'll be happy to answer questions a little later, but the rest of the program is equally exciting. Thank you, Carolyn. Back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sullivan. That was really outstanding and really just very wonderful to hear, actually. A lot of what you said is just so transformative. So thank you. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Zalewski. Dr. Zalewski is Vice Chair, Clinical Research, Chief Brachytherapy Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Radiation Oncology, Law Cornell Medical School. And Dr. Zalewski is going to talk about the role of radiation oncology, different types of radiation oncology, and managing bone metastases. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Zalewski.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be here as well to speak to you all about the role of radiation therapy for bone metastases. And I would start off by saying that radiation therapy has had an established role in the treatment of bone metastases for many decades already. It is well known that radiation therapy is a very successful way of palliating patients' disease when it is found in the bone. And I would say overall, when we give a course of radiation to an area where there is a documented bone metastasis, that the odds of reducing the pain in a significant way is generally around 70% of the time. So those are excellent odds for radiation to achieve a good result. And once again, the goal here is to reduce pain and hopefully reduce the need for an individual's requirement on narcotics or other pain relievers as well, if the source of the metastases is coming from that area of concern, which is the metastasis in the bone. In general, I would say that the usual or recommended approach for patients who receive radiation to bone metastases is a course of therapy that spans for about 2 weeks. And it is not unusual that these treatments, after about 2 weeks, start putting a dent and an improvement already in the pain. But it is important to note, and many oncologists don't always realize this, that it could take sometimes after a two-week course of treatment, which are these 10 sessions, it could take approximately another 2 to 4 weeks to achieve maximal pain relief. So patients shouldn't be disheartened if immediately after the course of a treatment there is no significant pain relief as of yet, because that pain relief could very well come over the ensuing 2 and 4 weeks of treatment. In general, the side effects of radiation therapy to the bone depends, of course, on the location of where the treatments are aimed at and the specific bone that we are dealing with. In general, if, let's say, there is a metastasis in a pelvic bone or a hip bone or an area of the spine, the treatments are very well tolerated. It could be associated with some fatigue, which is related to the fact that the marrow can be sometimes affected, and that's why it is important after a course of these treatments in cases where your oncologist is monitoring the status of situations to obtain blood counts, especially a blood count before the start of the treatment to make sure that all the blood parameters are acceptable, and even after the treatments, 2 to 4 weeks later, to make sure that the blood parameters such as the platelet count or the hemoglobin are at acceptable levels. As far as other side effects, really very unusual. It's well tolerated. What we generally recommend to people who get radiation to the bones, if they are symptomatic, is to make sure that they don't overdo any excessive activities or weightlifting, which could put pressure on the bone. And that is because when patients are getting radiation to the bone, in order to allow this to work, the radiation is affecting the tumor within the bone, and sometimes the bones can weaken immediately or during the treatment and for a few weeks to a few months after the treatment. So it's important after getting such treatments not to put undue stress on the bones itself. Sometimes after these treatments, there could be fractures which could develop, but fortunately, these fractures are somewhat rare after treatment. And I think just caution and prudence as to, for instance, not doing any weightlifting or any kind of excessive activities such as skiing or putting too much pressure on the bone should be avoided. Patients ask me what would be the best kinds of activity for undergoing or maintaining an exercise regimen, and in fact, some of the best exercises after radiation putting the least amount of stress on the bone is swimming, if that is a possibility. Now, there are some special situations where it's important to modify the scheme of the radiation. For instance, let's say the metastasis is found in a weight-bearing bone, such as in the femur, the thigh, where basically you're standing on that area and putting the weight on that region. And it is recognized as well that if the disease is involving a significant amount of a weight-bearing bone, then it would be important for the radiation oncologist, the oncology team in general, to refer the individual to the orthopedic surgeon. Because in some cases where the bone is deemed to be unstable, because there's a significant amount of disease that's involving that localized area of the bone, sometimes giving radiation could weaken the bone which is already so significantly weakened, and this could lead to a fracture. And the last thing we would really want to happen is a fracture during the treatment, because it could be a very complicated situation to repair. The best things and situations would be evaluation initially by the orthopedic oncologist, and in selected cases where the disease is found to involve a good part of the bone, a stabilization procedure where the bone can be strengthened, sometimes by a surgical procedure where a small rod or some device is put in to strengthen the bone, and then subsequently radiation treatments could be given for the purpose of addressing the disease. So sometimes what we call a multidisciplinary team, and that's generally what is usually the best for an individual, to have this multidisciplinary team addressing the treatment of metastases to the bone. And in this particular case, which I just mentioned, the collaboration between the orthopedic surgeon to address stability within the bone, followed by the radiation oncologist to address the disease within the bone, and then, of course, the medical oncologist to address the systemic disease at the same time, is going to serve the individual patient in the best way possible. Another special situation is when the disease is found near the spinal canal. And in those cases, even when there is no pain, many oncologists believe, and this include our team of oncologists at our institution, that even in the asymptomatic setting where there is no pain, because of the concerns that the disease could be impinging on some of the nerves or close proximity to the spinal canal and cord, that it is important to address those situations by giving the area radiation, not only to address the disease, but to hopefully lessen the chances or prevent the development of neurologic compromise and neurologic side effects that could happen if the disease kept growing and invading near the spinal cord. And one last point. There is a great deal of excitement now regarding the incredible accuracy and pinpoint nature of many new forms of radiation therapy. And these kinds of treatments are so much more accurate now, and you may have heard the term stereotactic radiosurgery or image-guided radiation, where in selected cases we can deliver more potent, higher radiation dose levels to the areas of the bone. This approach in particular is used when the amount of disease in the bone is limited to one, two, or three areas. And in those special cases, giving very focused high radiation dose levels with this approach known as stereotactic radiosurgery has been associated with incredibly good results, where we see not infrequently the stabilization of the disease, which means that the disease does not grow despite the passage of time. And that means that the treatments were successful in arresting the growth of the disease. And if the disease in the bone is limited, it may be something that you may want to ask your radiation oncologist about if it is appropriate or not. So there are indeed exciting areas and important issues we talked about regarding the management, the radiotherapeutic management of bone metastases. Thank you for your attention. I hand this over now to you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Zalewski. That was so informative and very helpful to everybody on the call, just providing all the different ways that radiation oncology can be so important and helpful, and just all the nuances that I think people often aren't aware of. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Covert. And Dr. Covert is an anesthesiologist at Pain Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Covert is going to address managing side effects, discomfort and pain, communicating with the healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Covert.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Today I'm going to talk about pain management principles, just in general, especially for cancer pain and also which apply to prostate cancer. As patients live longer with cancer, the need for effective pain control has gained increased importance for improving quality of life. It's extremely important that the patients, when they go for their treatments, can make their appointments on time, get to their appointments, and tolerate their chemotherapy or whatever treatments they're having, and not be in pain. There are plenty of barriers to effective pain control that are put up there by regulatory issues as well as pharmacies and fear. One of the fears of regulation of these drugs that we treat for pain, especially the opioids. And there are some physicians who are generally afraid to prescribe the medications because of fear of regulation. Other barriers to effective pain control, including underreporting by patients and families themselves, reimbursement issues. We are constantly fighting with the insurance companies to approve certain drugs. There really is no rhyme or reason. Sometimes they'll approve one medication and not approve another medication. We're constantly on the phone, and usually when we're on the phone, we get people who are not medical people, and we have to be extremely persistent. Other barriers to effective pain control include lack of aggressive treatment and then the fear of side effects. Many patients and families are reluctant to report pain. A lot of people feel that the tumor has spread when they have more pain. People always hear all the time want to save the opioids for when the pain gets worse. The pain may never get worse. And this brings up the issue of tolerance. What happens if I start taking pain medications and I need more later? Will it work? And that's what we call tolerance to the drug. And the way we deal with tolerance is by switching the drug. Sometimes by rotating the drugs, tolerance can be avoided. There's always concerns among patients about addiction. Addiction, though, has to be defined. There's physical addiction, which generally means that if you take an opioid medication, you are going to be physically dependent on the drug. And what that means is that when you need to come off the drug, you just need to come off of it slowly and be weaned off of it by a medical professional. And then there's psychological addiction, which I'm not going to say does not happen in cancer patients, but is very rare, because if you need the drug, you need the drug. And if you have pain, the instance of psychological addiction, or like a person who is doing it to get high, is extremely, extremely low. And also, people fear that that will distract the oncologist from curing the cancer. So to facilitate more effective means, it's important to know about different cancer pain syndromes as well as different types of pain. And cancer pain can be dynamic. It can be more than one pain site. There could be more than one etiology of the pain. Cancer-related pain is usually caused by either a direct tumor invasion of the bone, a nerve, or an organ. When a tumor invades a particular nerve or a group of nerves, we call that neuropathic pain. It feels kind of like lancinating, burning, stabbing, and it could even itch. An example of this would be if there was a metastatic lesion to a rib. Underneath the rib, there's a nerve, and that nerve wraps around your entire torso. And that could shoot all the way across around your entire chest wall. Another example would be neuropathy from chemotherapy. Primarily in the hands and the feet, people complain of burning, tingling, and painful paresthesias. When the organ involves an organ like the liver, the pain is called visceral pain. This kind of pain can be kind of hard to pinpoint the location, and some people describe it as dull, crampy, and achy. It can also refer to other places. If the lesion is irritating the diaphragm, the pain can be felt in the shoulder and not even where the lesion is. If the lesion involves a bone, the pain can be more precisely located usually, and it's called somatic pain. Again, described as achy and dull and usually worse with movement. So treating the pain, we usually start with a stepwise fashion. and try to do the least invasive thing possible first. The WHO ladder has come up with multiple steps to try to treat pain. And the first thing we usually try is a non-opioid plus or minus an adjuvant. An adjuvant might be a pain medication that we use for something called for nerve pain or neuropathic pain. The next step would be a mild opioid plus or minus an adjuvant. And the third step would be a more around-the-clock opioid, a more long-acting opioid plus or minus an adjuvant. And the fourth might be some sort of intervention to try to decrease the pain. So NSAIDs are very popular. You can get them over the counter. A lot of them are need prescriptions, but they are not necessarily as safe as you would think, even though you can buy Motrin and Aleve over the counter. Aleve is just naproxen. It's just half the dose of the regular prescription dose of naproxen. And if you take enough of it, it could really be harmful to kidney function and cause bleeding issues. And just because these drugs are over-the-counter does not necessarily make them safe. The NSAIDs can also interfere with chemo because they affect your platelet count, and so the chemo sometimes can lower people's platelet counts and then cause bleeding. And a lot of people are on anticoagulation, and again, that could promote bleeding as well. So you really have to be careful with NSAIDs and make sure that the oncologist is okay that you're taking these kinds of drugs too while you're getting treatment. Tylenol is another drug that you can get over the counter that can cause difficulties as well. The maximum daily dose of Tylenol should really not exceed 2 grams. In greater than 2 grams, it can cause liver dysfunction. And even though you can get it over the counter and you think it's safe, taking too much of it is not a good thing. Also, taking more than 1,000 milligrams at a time doesn't help anymore. So there is a ceiling effect of the Tylenol as well. Some of the opioids have Tylenol within them too. And these Tylenol preparations with that are combined with opioids have to be accounted for when you're taking more Tylenol on top of it. So that kind of brings us to the painkillers and the opioids. And they're classified in different ways. Some of them are mild, classified as mild, and some of them classified as strong. But there's really no such thing because everything really depends on the dose. If I call Vicodin or Percocet a weaker opioid, but I give you enough of it, it can be just as powerful as something stronger, such as Dilaudid or morphine. It really is dose-related. So the opioids include hydrocodone, which has Tylenol in it. They have made preparations with less Tylenol in it. Oxycodone, which does come without the Tylenol, but with Tylenol is called Percocet. Morphine, Dilaudid. There is a fentanyl, which comes in a patch, as well as some immediate forms, immediate release forms, Opana, and methadone. There are conversion charts between all these opioids. In other words, a certain amount of morphine is equivalent to a certain amount of Dilaudid, which is equivalent to a certain amount of oxycodone. When people hear morphine, they always think, That's it. That's the end drug. But it's really not that strong. And pound for pound, oxycodone is actually stronger than morphine. So there are short-acting opioids, which last about 4 hours. And then there are these longer-acting opioids, which are time-release pills, which last about 8 to 12 hours, and a patch. And the idea of the patch is that it gives a continuous amount of medications. The idea when you start taking one of these opioids is to try to obtain a steady state of pain release that lasts the whole day. You don't want these ups and downs. So if you're taking a short-acting opioid every 4 hours, you're kind of defeating the purpose. If you're in enough pain where the pain is all the time, then it might be time to take something longer-acting. So there's some in the bloodstream all the time, and the pain levels don't vary. By doing that, you might even take less of the medication in general by taking it more efficiently and have less side effects. So you're taking a short-acting drug continuously. You're now achieving a level, and then it's time to start with a long-acting drug. And somebody who's what we call opioid naive, who hasn't really taken any opioids, they usually start with a short-acting opioid to see if it's tolerated. And I kind of base it on what somebody's taken on for surgery or how it was taken in the past. If somebody's taken Dilaudid for surgery in the past, I know they tolerate Dilaudid. I might give them a small amount of very low dose of Dilaudid to start, and then add a long-acting opioid. Along with these so-called painkillers are adjuvant drugs, too. We use these drugs primarily for nerve pain, and there are different classes of these drugs. Some of them are anti-seizure medications. One of them is called Neurontin or Gabapentin. It's been around since the 1990s, and it works on receptors to decrease the firing of painful impulses. The one thing about Neurontin is you have to start very low and go slow and titrate upwards. You want to try to achieve a dose of about 1,200 to 1,800 milligrams a day. It sounds like a lot, but that's the dose of the medication. You usually start at about 100 milligrams three times a day and gradually increase it every 4 or 5 days. So we're starting at 300 milligrams, and we're trying to get up to a level of 1,200 to 1,800 milligrams to see if it will work, and then it might not work. So it's one of these things that you have to sort of give it a shot to see if it's going to help. And it can cause some sleepiness, but you kind of get used to it if you can just stick with it. Lyrica is another drug that's now seen on TV a lot. It's being marketed for something called fibromyalgia, but it's really good for nerve pain. It's also on the TV for neuropathic pain for diabetic neuropathy and also shingles. And that's what the drug was really studied for. But what we've learned is that the drug is really good for any kind of nerve pain. The problem with is sometimes getting the drug because it's really only approved for shingles and diabetic neuropathy. So you have to, your doctor has to be a little inventive when you want to try to get these drugs for other types of nerve pain. So again, you start really low and you titrate up, and maximum dose is 600 milligrams a day, and we're talking about starting at 100 milligrams a day. A lot of people are scared of the side effects of this drug because they see on TV a list of side effects that don't sound so great. The real side effects that we've been seeing is occasional edema of the ankles, which does go away when you stop taking the drug, some waking, and it can make you feel loopy, and sometimes can make your mood change. So those kind of things you have to look out for when you take that medication as well. But a lot of people are scared of it because they see it on TV and all the side effects associated with it. We haven't really seen horrendous side effects with it as with the other drugs, pretty much the same. So the other types of neuropathic pain medications are the old-time drugs that we used to use for depression. One of them is Elavil, and one of them is Pamelor. They've had a few side effects in the past, and that's why they're not really used for depression anymore. They can cause arrhythmias, dry mouth, and constipation. But they are very good for some types of neuropathic pain, especially neuropathy, and they are effective in lower doses than you would give for depression. Another drug that you've seen on TV a lot is Cymbalta. They try to market Cymbalta for muscle pain. Cymbalta is another antidepressant, and we've been using it for chemo-induced neuropathy. It does sometimes make people feel nauseous and not feel right, but for the most part, it's probably been the number one drug that we've had for chemo-induced neuropathy, more so than the gabapentin, the Lyrica, the Elavil, or the Pamelor. There's also topical pain relievers. There's a lidoderm patch. This patch has 5% lidocaine in it. It was typically made for shingles-type pain. We use it for a lot of different things now, muscle pain, nerve pain. There are really no side effects to the drug. Very little lidocaine gets absorbed into the bloodstream, but there are some people who are allergic to the adhesive. And there's always other alternatives, such as physical therapy. I think acupuncture is always a great thing to do, whether it be for pain, whether it be for nausea after chemo, or just general well-being, massage. And a lot of people now talk about the use of marijuana. Sloan Kettering has centers in New York and New Jersey. I work at the New Jersey office quite a bit. And in New Jersey, marijuana is legal. And if you go to the way you get it, and I can tell you my experience with it, is that you have to go to the Department of Health website and actually get a card saying you qualify to get the marijuana. The marijuana card is better if the person who's a patient actually goes and applies for it, because it will take a longer time if the caregiver tries to apply for it. Once you get the card, you have to go to a physician who can prescribe it. And there are a lot of different rules dictated by the state. And there aren't every state, again, it's not legal, but in New Jersey there are a lot of different rules of who qualifies for marijuana. When you get the prescription, it's really up to the dispensary, I have found out, of how they make it. And there are three dispensaries in New Jersey. And what they do is I talked to the owner of the one by where we are. He tailors the marijuana for nausea, for appetite, and for pain. And they use it as a vaporizer, or you can put it in food and eat it. What I've seen is that it's gotten a little pricey in New Jersey, depending on your insurance. Getting the card could be about up to $800. Getting the prescription could be about $200. So we're talking about $1,000 before you even get the marijuana. And then it seems to be about $150 a month. So it's turned into a whole ordeal as far as monetary issues for a lot of people. And what I've seen, it definitely seems to help people's appetite. I've seen pretty good results with the nausea, and I've seen okay results with the pain. And this is probably about 6 months in now with people really starting to use the marijuana. I don't think it's the all answer for everybody for pain. I just haven't seen it work as well as I would like to. Certainly when you get marijuana off the street, and again, I'm not an expert of that, but it's different than when you get marijuana from one of these dispensaries, as the purity of the marijuana is different. And there are certainly impurities of getting marijuana off the street that you don't want to put in your body. So if all these medications don't work, there are other modalities to try to help the pain. Sometimes we'll block painful nerves with local anesthetic and some cortisone. These things sometimes can be short-lived, and if they are short-lived but are effective, we can freeze nerves. We can kill nerves with alcohol as well, and we've done that to decrease the painful impulses from the inciting site. It's very important that we know where the pain is coming from. We can also give medications in different ways, and sometimes we'll give the opioids through a spinal pump, and this is an implanted pump that is put in by, we use a neurosurgeon to help us put this pump in. And the pump is basically filled with either morphine, Dilaudid, or fentanyl. And we'll use local anesthetic or numbing medicine also, which will numb the area of the pain, but hopefully not numb the person. And it's run by a computer, and it's totally implanted, and we can change the dose via this computer. So there are a lot of options to explore. The key is never to really to give up and to keep trying different things and to do it slowly and see which one is best tolerated and to do it in a stepwise fashion to try to find the right pain relief. I'll turn it back over to you, Dr. Mester.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kuppert. That was really excellent and really a very comprehensive overview of really pain management and how a pain service can really help to determine the most appropriate way to manage any discomfort or pain that someone's having and to do it really with expert knowledge. So thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Richard Dickens. Mr. Dickens is an oncology social worker, and he's our men's cancers program director at Cancer Care. And Mr. Dickens is going to address the three psychosocial programs and services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to host the program with Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hearing the words, you have cancer, is something no one ever forgets. Hearing the words, you have metastatic prostate cancer, for men and those who love them, raises its own set of concerns and introduces the patient and family to uncertainty and unwanted change, redefining who I am now and wondering who will I be after treatment. For all men and their loved ones, there are three important steps you can take to get answers. First, education, which encompasses speaking to professionals, understanding your disease and treatment options, hearing from other prostate cancer patients. A good place to start is with helpful organizations such as Cancer Care, who can guide you to reputable internet and other resources. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer goes a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Second, building or strengthening relationships, often defined as family, friends, workplace, medical team, house of worship, clubs, and groups. Starting with your medical team, don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern. It's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. Your doctor and oncology team, which includes a nurse, social worker, and other specialists, can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. They are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and life, so it is important to let them know when you have a question or something feels wrong. And finally, third, self-care, very important. A cancer diagnosis impacts people psychologically, physically, and often spiritually, which creates a lot of stress and pressure. Even when dealing with metastases, you usually have time before you must make a medical decision. Saying, I need a day to think about this, can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and other resources. For people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why building a support network is so important. By reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. A favorite quote of mine is, we can eat a whole elephant if we do it one bite at a time. Remember, self-care begins with breaking big problems into little pieces and addressing them one at a time. Cancer Care is oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include creating a phone tree, or for those who are computer savvy, a blog to keep people informed, or mind-body-spirit techniques such as meditation and imagery to calm the mind and relax the body during stress. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online groups for patients and loved ones. Many patients and caregivers want to speak with others who are going through the same thing to find out how they are coping and what resources they've found. Groups can provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. Along with Cancer Care, there are other organizations that help prostate cancer patients and families, such as US2 International, which is a prostate-specific organization, and Immerman Angels or Cancer Hope Network, both of which connect patients to patients and caregivers to caregivers for one-on-one connections. For many, social supports, getting to know your healthcare team, education, and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rick. That was really excellent. Thank you so much. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. And actually, you have really in front of you, I'm going to ask actually Candace to bring all of our speakers on board. And our speakers represent a multidisciplinary team, a medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, pain service expert, palliative medicine expert, and an oncology social worker. So you have quite a team here to ask questions of. And so I'm going to ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get your question, I'll let you know how to get further questions answered before the call ends. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1.
We have a question from one of our online participants from Joseph. Can radioactivity affect radiation therapy? Well, can radioactivity affect radiation therapy hurt my partner? Dr. Zalewski, could you address that question?
Sure. In general, for radiation therapy, which is called external radiation therapy, that there is no concern, radiation safety concern for the partner. Those issues come up when we put a radioactive source within the body, such as what you may hear about called brachytherapy or seed implants. And when those radioactive particles are within the body, then there are some radiation safety precautions which are necessary. But classically, radiation therapy delivered to the bone or any part of the body does not make the individual radioactive, and so it is safe to go around loved ones without any concern for harm for others.
Thank you. That is a question that often comes up, and I appreciate your addressing it so clearly. With another question from one of our online participants, the question... So the question actually is for Dr. Slovin. Are there certain genetic factors that contribute to the metastatic prostate cancer?
That's a great question, and unfortunately I would say that we can't point to any specific mutation. We do know that there are families that have a significant history with father, uncle, brother, and grandfather all having prostate cancer. We do know that patients with prostate cancer have a particular mutation called the TMPRSS, T-M-P-R-E-S-S, ERG, E-R-G mutation. However, whether or not some people acquire that earlier or later doesn't seem to make a difference. It does not appear to be any one specific mutation that is making your cancer pop up in the absence of any relevant family history. This is why we're looking for mutations that may come up later in life as a result of your cancer that would predispose to having a better treatment response. But hopefully in the next 6 months to a year, we might have an answer to that question.
Excellent. And stay tuned. There's lots coming up. And I think, Dr. Slovin, do you want to say something about the ASCO meeting coming up?
Yes. Well, the American Society of Clinical Oncology is probably the largest meeting, probably in excess of 30,000 medical oncologists and sometimes radiation oncologists, pain doctors, and the like, who are all there to discuss the newest and the biggest breakthroughs in cancers of all types. So it's not only for prostate, but hopefully our next program will be highlighting some of the new updates for a variety of different cancers, including prostate cancer. So it'll be at the end of the week, and by following week we'll have some updates.
Excellent. Yeah, that program, actually the first one, and Dr. Slovin will be speaking on that one, is actually on June 9th. It's a bit longer. It's from 1:30 to 3 p.m., and it will be addressing, including prostate cancer updates from that meeting. So stay tuned, I guess. And we have another question from one of our online participants, from David. So for Dr. Slovin, have you used immunotherapy in treating metastatic prostate cancer?
The answer simply is yes. We and others have looked at a variety of different vaccines and have not found them to be of any significant benefit. There is a FDA approved cellular product vaccine, which is really made of the patient's own cells that are removed. They are co-incubated with a protein and then returned back. So it's really one's own cells that are manipulated in a minor way. And that was the first FDA approved treatment for metastatic or minimally symptomatic prostate cancer. Now, the checkpoint inhibitors, which are a group of drugs, target a completely different mechanism of cellular growth. It's not to the cancer itself, but to the cells that protect your body, the immune cells, such as T cells. And those have shown fairly dramatic anti-tumor effects in bladder cancer, kidney cancer, lung cancer, but have not shown substantial anti-tumor effects in prostate cancer. So again, this continues to be a work in progress. There is a phase 3 trial with another vaccine called Prostvac that was developed at the NCI. However, it is still under analysis, so we really will not have the read for at least another year. And again, here too is where a lot of the showcases of immunotherapy will be at this ASCO meeting, and hopefully we'll have updates on that in the next 2 weeks.
Thank you. Actually, a question for Dr. Hubbard. In terms of if you could describe, because we have people on the call from all over the United States, a little bit more about the pain service, in terms of what it involves and how people can request that sometimes if they are having pain. If you could just say a little bit more about that, all the team members.
Usually, we get referrals from everybody, from surgeons, from medical oncologists, from radiation oncologists. And basically, people have different comfort levels in prescribing these medications. And sometimes the oncologists would rather take care of it themselves. A lot of times they'll ask us for certain things like procedures and blocks and pain pumps, and other times they'll want us to try to prescribe medications and try to get the right formula for the pain as well. It's really helpful to have good nurses as well, and good nursing staff and good follow-up to try to really get the right pain regimen for you and to tailor to your needs.
Thank you. And the question, and thank you, so it's really important that people realize they can request that if they're feeling that their pain is just that they need more help with their pain. Is that correct?
In our hospital, people do it all the time. And everybody here is pretty much amenable to it as well. Just request it and hopefully your oncologist will be the same.
Mm-hmm. And then a question for Dr. Zaleski, another. What is 3D conformal radiation therapy?
3D conformal radiation is a form of the external radiation, and the 3D conformal focuses on the computer planning software that's used to help target the radiation. Conformal means that the radiation beam is shaped in the same configuration as the target or the bone metastases or the prostate, whatever you happen to be aiming at. And the conformal means that it is very tightly sculpted, that radiation beam, around the target that you're aiming at. Three-dimensional emphasizes that we're taking into account not only the target we're aiming at, but the normal tissues, such as the bladder or the bowels or the rectum or the like, into account. So it's a form of radiation that is considered highly targeted and more focused. And in general, most of the radiation treatments around the United States take advantage of this technology.
Excellent. Well, I would like to thank our speakers. They've been extraordinary. This has been an amazing program. I want to thank our speakers, and I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions. And I also want to acknowledge all of you who've been on the call and listening and may have a question that you still didn't have a chance to have answered. So I want to first address that. So if you do have a question, particularly a question about the management of your metastatic prostate cancer, please do call the National Cancer Institute, and there number is 1-800-422-6237. It's a wonderful resource for you to have for any of your questions that might be medically focused. If you have any questions that or any need for services from Cancer Care, then I would suggest that you call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, you can go to our website at www.cancercare.org. Our staff, our oncology social work staff, are here to help you with all the practical and financial concerns you may have, with with counseling services, a chance to talk with someone, with our support groups, both our telephone and online support groups, And, of course, our whole array of services, our upcoming workshops that we offer, as well as our publications. And I want to just remind all of you that we do have a part two of this program on June 10th for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer. So that might be of interest to all of you. And we also have a program coming up actually on June 9th, which is the highlights from ASCO, which will include a presentation on updates on prostate cancer as well. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. And most importantly, as the call is about to end, we don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with metastatic prostate cancer, in coping with cancer, or any of the issues or concerns that you may have. Please know that our staff are here at Cancer Care. Our oncology social workers are here to help you, and we are simply a telephone call away. Or you can pose your question or ask for help from us also on our website. Again, I want to thank you all and wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.